Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of whether the tide of battle in Syria is turning in favor of the Assad dictatorship and what that might have to do with talks soon to take place brokered by Russia and the United States. Chris Tensing, an Arabic-speaking specialist on Syria who is the Executive Director of the Middle East Research and Information Project and editor of the Middle East Report, joins us to discuss recent changes on both the battlefield and in the diplomatic arena. Then we will speak with Princeton historian Julian Salazar about his article at CNN, What Happened to Obama's Promise, and discuss the criticism of the president coming from his disillusioned supporters on the left who expected a transformational president instead of a transactional one. We will examine whether reform is possible in Washington and what Obama could and should do to motivate his spiritless supporters to vote in 2014. Then finally, we look into the power of the telecom oligarchs in the new Gilded Age, who are the contemporary equivalent of the railroad barons, but exert unprecedented influence over us as the gatekeepers of news and information. Susan Crawford, who served as Special Assistant to President Obama for Science, Technology, and Innovation Policy, and is the author of the new book Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age, joins us to talk about how America, where the Internet revolution began, is slipping further and further behind as Americans get gouged by monopolies who charge more and more for less and less service. Joining us now is Chris Tensing, who is an Arabic-speaking specialist on Syria. He's the Executive Director of the Middle East Research and Information Project and editor of the Middle East Report. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Tensing.
Thank you.
And clearly this battle for this key town in Syria seems to be a bellwether for this long and painful civil war, and indications are that the Assad's may turn the tide of battle in their favor with the help of Hezbollah. And of course, we know that Iran and Russia have been doubling down in supplying arms. How critical do you think this battle is?
Well, I think it's important to note that no matter if the regime is able to prevail in this particular battle and win this particular ground back from the rebels, it is extremely unlikely that the Syrian regime is ever going to exercise full control over the entire territory of the country of Syria in the way that it did before the rebellion broke out. So these battlefield advances that are being reported are about its relative position vis-a-vis the rebellion. The overall picture is still, I think, a balance of weakness, with neither side able to win definitively or decisively, and for the time being, at least, the various international powers that are sending aid to the combatant parties not willing to send aid that would tip the scales decisively in the favor of either side.
So there's also conflicting reports that support the notion that maybe in the long run, if this is a short-term victory for the Assads and for Hezbollah, in the long run, there are indications that the Assads and the Alawites are maybe preparing for a kind of enclave, a partition of the country along the northwestern coast of Syria, the traditional Alawite homeland, and which, of course, right in the middle of that is the Russian naval base of Tartus.
Yeah, I'm skeptical of that line of analysis because it goes against, you know, everything, every ideological stance that the Ba'athist regimes in Syria have always taken. It's a mistake to characterize the Syrian regime as an Alawi regime or to imply that the Assad family is somehow recognized and hailed as the leader of the Alawi community. That's not the case. There are lots of Alawis in Syria who loathe the regime just as much as anyone else. The problem is that, in large part because of the regime's own divide-and-rule policies over the several decades, not to speak of during the Civil War itself, that sectarian fears have been so whipped up that for a lot of Alawis, they sort of feel trapped, that even though they loathe the regime and do not consider it to be their representative in any way, they fear that if the regime falls, they would be held collectively responsible and collectively guilty for the regime's many crimes over the years. And that is a fear that the regime has has willfully stoked and one that it knows plays to its advantage. So I do think that probably the regime's reported successes on the battlefield are about strengthening its negotiating position vis-a-vis the rebels and vis-a-vis the international community. They see perhaps an opportunity now to get something at the negotiation table, which is more than negotiating the terms of their own demise and, you know, would have been their literally their own physical demise until recently, perhaps.
And of course, Chris Tunsing, an Arabic-speaking specialist on Syria, who is executive director of the Middle East Research and Information Project and editor of the Middle East Report. These talks, of course, are the result of Secretary of State Kerry's trip to Russia. And for the longest time, it appeared that the U.S. had castigated both China and Russia for vetoing UN resolutions and didn't seem to want to talk to the Russians. Those days seem to be over. Is that what you're referring to in terms of what the Assad see as an opening for them in terms of being in a better position? So that would assume that these talks are going to happen. And I guess my first question is it likely that the Assads would sit down with the rebels? These people hate each other in ways that we can't even comprehend.
That's the $60,000 question, and I think you're entirely right that the other thing that seems to have changed in the big picture, besides these, what seems to be, at least relatively speaking, a turning of the military tide in Syria, is the stance of Russia. And until last week, Russia seemed to be immovable in its staunch support for Syrian regime, whatever the Syrian regime's position was. Now, it seems that by dint of this U.S.-Russian announcement of shared support for political talks, which came out of Kerry's trip, that, you know, one would assume that Russia is prepared to exert some pressure on Assad to come to the negotiating table. But that's the other $60,000 question, whether Russia, in fact, is prepared to do that and will do that, because that would probably be necessary. And, you know, another thing that could be happening as a result of what's happening on the battlefield is that the regime is less willing to negotiate as opposed to more. It's hard to say what's going on in their minds, of course.
Well, of course, Putin, after he'd met with Kerry, met with the Israeli Prime Minister, and apparently it was a pretty contentious meeting. And subsequent to that, we've learned that the Russians are supplying some advanced ground-to-ground missiles, which are anti-ship missiles, which may well be intended to keep the Israeli Navy at bay. So what do you think went on in those talks? And obviously, you'd have to add to this the fact that recently Israel struck at the heart of the Assad regime at the airport, allegedly stopping missiles from getting to Hezbollah. But they also seem to have struck Republican Guard positions right on the very doorstep where the president's palace is on top of Mount Kaisun.
Right. And the coincidence of all these events is certainly interesting and certainly tempts one to make some connection between them. And they may not be connected, but it is certainly tempting to think that the Israeli strikes and Israel's were intended as some kind of prod to the United States to do something, quote-unquote, and that the U.S.-Russian initiative is therefore a way of trying to contain this crisis, to try and stop it from escalating further militarily, certainly not spiraling into a multi-front regional war, and therefore to sort of get Israel to cool its jets a little bit, if you'll pardon the metaphor.
Well, it seems to me that both the Israelis and the Syrians may be playing some kind of brinksmanship here to test the other side. The fact that Israel has struck twice now deep inside Syria and done serious damage, and Syria has not retaliated, would indicate something, I imagine. And then conversely, the fact that it looks as though Syria may have been behind the Assads, that is, may have been behind a very limited use of chemical weapons to test Western resolve and reaction. And also the bombing inside of Turkey, where a bunch of civilians were killed on Turkish territory. That might have been, well, another example of the Assads testing Turkey's resolve. In both cases, Turkey seems to have rolled over, and the White House rolled over on their red line.
Yes, I mean, as far as the chemical weapons, it's still not apparent how much illicit substances were used and by whom. But I do think that there is, as you said, some testing of boundaries going on. And certainly the decision of Syria not to retaliate to the Israeli strikes, as it did not retaliate in 2007 when Israel struck its supposed nuclear research facility, is clearly intentional and calibrated as a way of basically declining to be provoked into some kind of confrontation that Syria would lose, the Syrian regime would definitely lose. And Hezbollah figures into that as well, because one thing that Israel could do in counter-retaliation, if you will, if Syria were to retaliate for strikes, it would be to hit Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Well, there is, apparently. I've talked to some strategists who are following what's going on in the neighborhood, both in terms of the immediate war and the extent to which it's a surrogate war with outside players. And I think it was Aram Nagezian at the Center for Strategic and International Studies who suggested that it's very tempting for Israel now, with Hezbollah being involved in Syria, and they're apparently in the midst of this key battle that's going on now. There's a lot of Hezbollah fighters in there, that it may be tempting for Israel to do a flanking movement from the Golan Heights, as because Hezbollah is otherwise diverted in fighting in Syria. Do you think that's a possibility? I mean, it would change the whole calculus, surely, and it'd make it an Arab-Israeli war as opposed to an intra-Arab war, a civil war.
Correct. And I do think that there is a danger that some in the Israeli establishment would press for such an opportunistic use of this crisis. Since the 2006 war, both people in Israel and pro-Israel commentators here in the West have been saying that round two, so-called round two of the 2006 war, was virtually inevitable. But the fact that Hezbollah fought the Israeli army to a standstill on the ground, and that its entire arsenal of rockets and so on was not destroyed and has subsequently been replenished, meant that it was just a matter of time before Israel would seek to strike Hezbollah again with comparable force. And it could very well be that some in Israel see this crisis in Syria as an opportunity to deal Hezbollah a more severe blow than was dealt in 2006. And indeed, that would change the dynamics of the Syria crisis completely, turning it into an Arab-Israeli conflict. There already has been, as a result of the Israeli airstrikes, some effect to which the rebels in Syria are cast as objectively pro-Israel, quote-unquote. And that, of course, is assumed to redound to their discredit, not to their benefit politically, and to the regime's benefit politically within Syria and within the larger Arab world. And certainly if there were to be a bigger war that were to break out, and especially if Israel were seen to have a hand in provoking it, that one could expect the Syrian regime to benefit at least temporarily politically from that. And so that, I think, also figures into the Syrian regime's calculations here.
But who in the world would believe that the al-Nusra Front, this al-Qaeda-affiliated group, is in any way less than hostile towards Israel? And indeed, my understanding is amongst the Free Syrian Army and the more secular and the ones that started this revolution, as opposed to those who came in and took advantage of it, like al-Qaeda, if that's indeed the way to describe the al-Nusra people, is that they've always thought that the Assads were too cozy with the Israelis. In other words, if anything, the rebels are more anti-Israel than the Assad regime.
That may well be true, and that's a huge irony of the situation. But I don't think it would stop the Syrian regime from trying to cast the situation in classic Arab-Israeli terms, sure, should it come to that.
Well, they've already done that at any rate and tried that. Every time Israel struck, they've blamed it on the rebels. So Chris Tensing, again, an Arabic-speaking specialist on Syria, who's the executive director of the Middle East Research and Information Project and editor of the Middle East Report. What explains the fact that early in this war, both Hillary Clinton and the Turks in particular thought this would be a cakewalk and that Assad would fall just as Mubarak and the other relics of Arab dictatorships did in the Arab Spring? Something's obviously changed now, and they changed the Turkish calculus because the prime minister was at the White House, and he hasn't responded against the bombing inside Turkey, which presumably came from the Assad. So have they just recalibrated what's going on? And is because Hillary Clinton went public with this confident idea that Assad would fall, has that basically hamstrung Obama? Has that tied his hands?
Well, I think that the U.S. and Turkey and other governments made an analytical error, which has been made by a lot of independent analysts as well, and been something that's been hard for a lot of outsiders to understand, which is that the Syrian regime, for all of its undoubted depredations over the years and its undoubted brutal authoritarian rule that Syrians of all backgrounds suffer from equally, does have a base, a political and social base, that has remained resilient to a large degree, even after this last 2 years of horrible fighting. And the reasons for that are complicated. They are partly related to the way that the regime has stirred up sectarian fears over the years. They're partly related to the regime's divide and rule tactics. They're partly related to the vicious sectarian behavior on the part of some of the rebel groups and the atrocities that rebel groups have committed, which have given credence to the fear that Alawis, for example, would be held collectively guilty for the crimes of the Assad regime should that regime fall and a successor regime come to power. But so the fears explain part of it. There is also the fact there is a business elite in Syria that has, for the most part, stuck with the regime, in part because it's basically complicit in a lot of what the regime has done over the years and would rise and fall with the regime. So there is this political base that the regime has managed to hold on to. And so it's not like Egypt or Tunisia, where you really did have a situation where a divided regime with significant internal cracks was facing basically a heterogeneous, unified population. In Syria, the opposite has been true, where you have basically a coherent and unified regime without significant cracks that has faced a quite heterogeneous and divided population.
Well, Chris Tensing, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Chris Tensing, who's an Arabic-speaking specialist on Syria, who is the executive director of the Middle East Research and Information Project and editor of the Middle East Report. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about what happened to Obama's reform agenda.
I'd be